Hi, I'm Simona Capizzani.
And I'm Alex Lee.
And welcome to another episode of A Hostile Climate.
This week, we're talking about responsibility and outdoor recreation. Simo, you've been getting outside?
A little bit between the work. I have been able to get outside, most notably. Realize how much I've missed the outside lately after doing a lot of 10-hour hikes in the Alps over the course of a week while I was at the World Biodiversity Conference with some of our friends.
That sounds really tough for you.
It was really hard.
That sounds really like it must have been really tough for you.
My job is really hard. So everyone should take pity. You know what
By
I actually...
By the way, it's like...
What?
It's like my favorite summer question is the like... Instead of talking about the weather or, everyone's fed up with politics right now.
Yeah.
So you've been getting out?
Yeah. Been getting out. Been definitely getting out.
You've been getting out? Like, I just think that's such a, it's such a funny question, but it seems like, it's the summer.
It's relevant. Although, in England, not so much because it's basically the same weather as it's been the whole time. But you know what I actually did realize was how much I missed getting out with other fellow nerds, environmental nerds, environmental philosophy nerds. So shout out to a few of our friends that I was able to go hiking with. And like pausing and finding, Arctic newts on the trail, or finding, the mandibles of a marmot, which both our friend Yasha and I took both halves home to our respective wives. And I don't know, Emma probably enjoyed it, but my wife did not and told me to take that shit outside. So in general, excellent.
I think you're like, this is part of why we started this podcast, right? Is that we thought that a lot of people, when you think about philosophy, you think about like elbow patches in a room full of leather bound books or something like that. And as we keep saying, we want to touch grass
exactly.
And we think that's really important.
Exactly. And it really is like we really did talk about philosophy while we were walking, situated in Switzerland, which is literally a cliche of itself, with cows and wildflower meadows and a lot of snow and ice still. I think the proof of the podcast was in that pudding this week or past week. Anyway, have you been getting out? What you been doing?
I've been getting out a bit. I've been spending some time hiking with my daughter in a backpack, which is pretty fun. She now like will giggle and say hiking, but she's also like,
that's great.
It's like that kid's getting kind of big for the backpack.
I was just gonna say, is she between like
all the parents out there
/ carrying her?
She's full walking, but yeah. She still is willing to be in the backpack for a while.
Yeah.
So, there's going to be this moment where I'm already hitting the moment where I can do less.
Yeah.
Because she doesn't want to stay in a pack forever and she wants to walk herself some.
Yeah.
But it's pretty amazing to see like a little kid get curious about nature for the first time.
Oh,
so I'm stoked on that.
Is she just like touching things and looking at things? And
She'll just say flower and like point at flowers and say their color, or like she makes the buzzing sound if she sees like a bee or a fly.
Oh.
And she just like likes pointing at things and like trying to identify them. It's friggin' adorable.
It's gonna be so amazing as you increase. I mean, I have visceral memories of being taken outside very, very young, to the point that they're those kinds of memories that you're not sure if they're dreams or not. And I'm just so grateful for my parents to do that, because it just, it becomes part of you very early.
Well, I think it's also one of the things that instills a concern for nature
and
right?
care. Yeah. Which honestly,
and care. The more time you spend outside, the more you not only like appreciate and connect with it, but I think the more sense of responsibility you feel.
And dare I say, we thought today that we might hone in on this very concept of responsibility and connection to nature. So who did you think was a good person to chat about this with?
We talked about this idea, and I thought it'd be cool to talk to a professional athlete. I think outdoor athletes especially are in this position where they have both the platform of a professional athlete and a deep sense of care and concern for the natural world that's motivated through their sport.
Yeah.
Through getting out.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. And
they get out a lot. They're getting out.
They're getting out professionally.
They're getting out. It's their job.
No, I mean, really, I feel like people that are exceptionally well situated to also be able to perceive the changes that are happening that might imbue folks with more of a responsibility to be speaking out, especially if over the course of a somewhat longer career in the outdoors, you're able to see what has shifted and what hasn't, or what conditions, you know, feel like.
I also think to some extent, the style of communication and the conversation in the outdoor community is a little different than the climate conversation more broadly. I actually think it's a little less political. Or at least at times can be a little less political. So like, as you know, like I climb a lot and I ski a lot and I spend a lot of time in the mountains, and those spaces aren't necessarily, those don't feel like partisan spaces to me. Mm-hmm. And maybe others will disagree and totally slam me for saying that. But I actually think that it's created a sort of a conversation that is maybe a little less loaded than otherwise. Like skiers, it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican. Like if you're a skier, you've noticed that the season is changing.
Yeah.
You can't help but notice that the season's changed.
Yeah.
And so, you know, folks that spend a lot of time in the outdoors, really caring about the outdoors, I think are more receptive to a sort of bigger tent of concern and mm-hmm. and language and different styles of communication around it. It's also an incredibly privileged space.
Yeah, of course.
So it right, like of course there's a different set of baggage that comes with that, but I do think that there's sort of a unique kind of conversation. And today, a ton of Americans from across the spectrum spend a lot of time outside.
Yeah.
And recreate in the outdoors.
Yep. Yep. I'm thinking even, you know, of the surf community, which I don't know if it's more proletariat or not than the mountain community, because maybe you just need less equipment. I'm not sure if that's necessarily the case. There's plenty of privilege in the surf community, but there is a wide swath of, like, for the most part, if you have a board and you're close to the coast or can get to the coast, you're able to get out there. And there are similarities where I think politics sometimes does come up in the water or is an element. So I wouldn't say it's necessarily an apolitical space, but you have an absolute common grouping. So to your point, right, if you take whatever kind of outdoor sport and kind of chunk it up and look at the demographics that are there, I would imagine, you know, and hopefully this is also increasing because we know that access to the outdoors is itself a justice-based question, but you do see a wide range of the population and maybe less of a homogeneous one.
And as we, you know, as we talk about this, like it's important to remember the outdoors isn't just, it's not just like the extreme sports, right? It's not just like surfing and skiing and climbing and stuff like that. It's, you know,
taking a walk outside,
going for a walk. It's walking on your local trails. It's birding, it's canoeing, it's, you know, taking your kids to pick blueberries. There's such a huge spectrum of ways to, you know, care about and engage with the outdoors through recreation that it is a really big tent. As you know, recently I've been working with the organization Protect Our Winters. Protect Our Winters, or POW, is a nonprofit that engages the outdoor community in climate advocacy and action. My personal role there is that I'm part of an alliance of climate researchers that works with the organization. And, you know, we're mostly folks with academic backgrounds, mostly a bunch of professors from around the country that do research on climate science, different elements of climate change. And we want to support POW in educating the outdoor community and in engaging the outdoor community around climate change solution building, right? POW started as an organization of outdoor athletes. So, you know, us researchers are sort of newer to the party. It was founded by the snowboarder Jeremy Jones as a way to rally athletes around supporting climate action. And right now, the captain of their alliance of athletes is a professional alpine climber named Graham Zimmerman. Graham's awesome. So I called up Graham and he agreed to chat with us about this. Graham Zimmerman is a professional climber. He's the former president of the American Alpine Club, the current captain of the Protect Our Winters Athlete Alliance. He's won a PLA d'Or, which is like the gold medal in alpine climbing. You can't apply for it. It's not a competition. It's just that, like, if you do something amazing, the mountaineering community gives this to you.
He climbed a peak in also, Pakistan, correct? Is that where he got
the that? Yeah, he won that. So him and his team got that for first ascent on a peak called Link Sar. He's also an author. He just wrote a memoir that just came out about his journey as an athlete and his journey as an activist and climate advocate. So we thought that, you know, I thought he'd be the perfect person to chat with about this. So let's hear what Graham has to say.
So, yeah, climbing has been my main thing for a long time. I've been kind of a professional alpine climber for 15, 20 years. And over the last 10 years, climate advocacy has become a really big part of that. And I think that, you know, what we're going to talk about some today is responsibility. And as somebody who has spent a lot of time in high altitude, high latitude parts of the world, places where we are seeing some of the most dramatic impacts from climate, spending time in those landscapes and with the communities that exist within those landscapes, I feel a really important responsibility to represent those places and be a part of the change that we need in order to decarbonize. And I'll share that something that I think about a lot and something that I'm excited for us to dig into is that a lot of the focus of my work has been not only on how do we decarbonize, but how do we move away from the idea that personal change, such as not eating meat or not flying or not driving, how do we move away from those solutions on climate, and how do we move towards systemic solutions, solutions that bring everybody along on that journey and really impact the overall systems that we live in? And that's something that I'm really excited to dig into with y'all.
Awesome.
That is excellent. Yeah, that's absolutely something I think that we're gonna touch on. But you know, just to pick up right where you kind of started about really being like having a front row seat, right, in these high alpine environments. If you had to say maybe one of the things that you're noticing the most that you're worried about, whether it's to the natural environment and the communities that live in those spaces, what would you say those things are?
It's a really big question. I'll share that academically speaking, I have a background in glaciohydrology, and that's a long time ago now, but glaciohydrology being how water flows over, through, and under glaciers. And so when I'm interfacing with those environments, something that I really trend towards is looking at those big moving chunks of ice in those environments and how they're being impacted by the climate crisis, and subsequently how those changes in those features are impacting the communities around them. And when we start looking at that, we start seeing challenges around water scarcity, the glaciers in the high mountains of the world and places like the Karakoram really act as the water reserves that allow for those places to be livable in what is an otherwise very arid climate. And then they're also creating a massive natural hazard for communities that are living up in those valleys. You all are probably familiar that glacial recession oftentimes results in the formation of a large lake. That body of water can release because it's held in by the terminal moraine. And the release of that water is something that has been devastating communities all over the big mountains of the world. And so when I'm working with these folks who are out in these areas, and we're talking about how we resource them on climate, we're having conversations not about their carbon footprint or not about their vote. Like my buddy Rasul, who lives up in the village of Hushe in the Pakistani Karakoram, he's a community leader up there and somebody who would consider a really close friend and somebody I've spent a lot of time with. And he's not thinking about his carbon footprint. He's not thinking about his vote. He like literally doesn't have either. When he's thinking about climate, he's thinking about building gabions, those big like baskets of rocks, in order to make sure that when those big glacial floods come through, that his village doesn't get washed away. He's thinking about those scarcity problems around water, where there is less snowpack, less glacial ice, and how they can continue to grow crops that will allow for his community to survive. And so it's you know, bringing them with me, bringing folks like Rasul into my work. And, you know, when I think about what I'm doing and why I'm taking this on is something that's really important, because he is in a fully reactive place. He is in a place where everything he's doing is not about decarbonization. It's not about systemic change. It is about like mitigation on the front lines of this problem.
Yeah. There's both this like, there's this incredible visceral reaction that I think people have to big landscape changes that you're speaking to, right? Like, especially when we're seeing geologic time sped up to a human timeline, right? Yeah. And it's both for, I think, this sort of emotional reaction where you see something that feels like it should be like the ultimate, like stable, like sometimes literal rock in our world. Or, you know, we think about mountains as sort of timeless. And then you see them move to the state of instability that's sort of jarring emotionally, but also, as you say, like extremely practically jarring and creates these like existential threats to people. Yeah, I mean, that seems like such an important thing for us all to notice, that we all can notice, but that you kind of have a real front row seat to, as we said. I'm curious, Graham, like as you've seen those changes in some of the places that you love, I know it also affects your sport quite directly as well. Where you can go, how you have to travel. How has that kind of changed how you think about climate change or motivated some of your work?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that in terms of how the mountains are being impacted, there, you know, in terms of how it's like, how is climate change impacting the practice of climbing? I'll share that that's oftentimes something I don't focus on too much, because I think that it'd be pretty obnoxiously privileged yeah. of me to like focus on that as like the primary yeah. thing, but like it's for sure having an impact. Like the prime climbing season in Yosemite is moving back into November. A lot of the prime climbing season, which tends to be in the fall across the Western United States, is being badly impacted by wildfire smoke. When we start looking at the big mountains of the world, they are changing in ways that mean that we're having to modify when we go and where we go. And something that's really interesting is that it is making long-term community knowledge less valuable, because for years the climbing community has built this body of knowledge around where we go and how we go to these places.
Yeah.
And while maybe like I'm going and I'm focusing on a particular wall in a valley in Pakistan, you know, the approach to it or where you set up base camp or how you get to that section of the mountains is something that is, you know, in which I am generally following those who have come before me. And in many cases, we're kind of having to throw out a lot of that knowledge, because as the mountains are changing so quickly, those approaches are changing. Those base camps that were maybe once in safe locations are no longer safe. That kind of stuff is really creating a pretty big impact on like our ability to make safe decisions in the mountains. And like you were talking about just a moment ago, with the collapse of some of these peaks up in the French Alps, same thing's happening all over the world. And it's super interesting, because we have this sport of climbing that is growing, and we have more people going to the mountains. And at the same time, those mountains are changing at a rate at which like it's really hard to communicate about how to keep people safe. It's something that's happening dramatically down in Patagonia right now, particularly in the Chelten Massif, like Fitzroy and Cerro Torre, those kind of big classic peaks that are like the logo of the Patagonia brand. Like a lot of people are going down there for their first expeditions right now. They're going to climb in those peaks, and it's really exciting to have them doing that. But also because the deep permafrost in those mountains is collapsing, like those mountains are falling apart. And so you have more people going to the mountains at a time when the mountains are becoming less stable. And that is a pretty tricky dynamic.
I was going to ask about this connecting with the outdoors, bringing the outdoors to people's living rooms, so to speak, and the stories that you're telling. You wrote a book, you know, creating short films on all this sort of thing to motivate and care about the impacts of climate on communities and on the natural world itself. Do you often find that you're able to do this, depending on your audience, to make explicit connections to climate change, or do you feel like you have to shift messaging when you're trying to advocate as someone who's in the sort of outdoor recreational space? Like, how much are you able to connect those kinds of dots?
That's a super cool question. And it's super audience dependent, of course. And on a broad scope, I tend to break the audiences that I work with into three categories. One is the outdoor rec community, and that's a group who we have a lot of shared language, and a lot of that community sees going to the outdoors as a time and a place where they can escape all of the shitstorm that is the world around us. Sorry. Can we swear on this podcast?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Great.
Swear the fuck
all you fucking want.
Fuck yeah. Great news. And that's something I don't want to take away from people. I think that going to the outdoors and turning your phone off is a crucial component of mental health and a real benefit of going to the outdoors. I also want to empower those folks to leverage those stories from those areas in order to be a really key component of the climate change conversation, and encouraging people that we can hold both those things, that you can have that space to get away, but you can also leverage those stories in order to drive the change that we need, and that those stories are one of our most potent tools. So with the outdoor rec community, that's how I'm communicating with them. Like, hey, you are the trusted messengers that we need in order to drive this change. And at POW, we work with trusted messengers who are also like effectively like the grass tops members of the community leaders in terms of like athletes and scientists and creatives and CEOs, which is a huge part of the reason why I like super believe in that work. And then as we start looking at people who are not as like deeply entrenched or not a part of the outdoor rec community, you know, we start to look at people who either are like in on the climate change conversation or people who are like not quite in on the climate change conversation. And within those two conversations, I really work to drive engagement with storytelling, which is super important. We can bring people in with those stories. We can create literal common ground with these landscapes that we all appreciate. And then within that conversation, if somebody is trending liberal, trending towards a like similar ideology that I have in terms of how we should get out the world around us, then we can start talking about the climate crisis. We can start talking about climate justice. We can start talking about like how all these things intersect and how we need to move forward on them together, how we need to move towards we need to start moving towards systemic solutions that allow for us to bring everybody along on this decarbonization journey, not just the people who can afford EVs and solar panels. And then when we start talking to folks who are maybe trending a little more to the ideological right, that becomes a really interesting space where we start having to cut out some of the terms and some of the kind of ideology that I love, you know, like I love like talking about the climate crisis, talking about moving forward together. Those are things I really enjoy and believe in. But we have to start talking about other things like the economy, like energy security, like jobs. And we have to start like kind of digging in on those components so that we can bring them on side. Similarly, though, I do think that within those, the outdoor stories do hold a really strong place of storytelling and creating shared spaces. It just requires some like audience research in order to know what landscapes they're into, how they're thinking about those landscapes.
So I think that's super interesting, because I think that speaks to something that's like really important in this political moment we're in. The outdoors is not a particularly partisan place. while climate change certainly can be, right? But like like, as we now know, what is it, 170 million Americans engaged in outdoor recreation last year in some way, right? So, okay, this is something that across the political spectrum, people believe in. And it doesn't seem to me like it's a particularly political message to say that no matter who you are, we have a responsibility to take care of these places that we're recreating in, engaging in, that we care about, that we love. It does seem like the climate language gets in the way of that sometimes for purely political reasons, right? But I'm kind of wondering if you, like, when you have those conversations across the aisle, how do you find ways of depoliticizing that idea of responsibility and depoliticizing that sort of like deeper concern you have to folks that, yeah, like, is it really just the language that gets in the way? Or do you find a path to share stories from climbing, stories from the outdoors, your personal story as a way in to some of those shared understandings of care for the natural world?
I'm going to do something that's probably like a faux pas, which is pile on a question.
Yeah. Pile on.
I want to devil's advocate Alex a little bit. Please. Not really, but like, so there's these questions about, yes, the outdoors being a potential for depoliticizing. I guess I have like a normative or an ought question to footnote Alex's point, which is like, ought we be striving for depoliticizing it? Because while many people do see and have access to recreational spaces, it is a political point to say that access to the outdoors is a justice question. Sure. And is itself a political question, right? Most disenfranchised communities of color that are around the national parks are the least likely to have access or be able to have education and space to it. We know, you know, certain communities of color don't necessarily feel safe in outdoor spaces for lots of different kinds of reasons. So I'm just wary about that, this question of like, if we are going to have narrative and connection to the outdoors be a unifying message, how do you do that without totally stripping it from, and is it just a language question in terms of, or a framing question, or is it really like a place that is depoliticized? So I have questions to Alex's point about whether it is or not, but maybe you can handle all of that.
Maybe I should have just said less partisan, not depoliticized.
Okay.
Yeah,
fine.
I mean, depoliticized, I mean, make it less partisan. I think that, let's see, I'm going to like, I'm not going to come at you with like a real salient answer here. And instead, I think answer.
That's fine. This was like a trap, apparently. So.
I think you have teed up a really important part of the discussion. And I think that there are a couple of things that feel like good spots for us to explore. I think the first is that I think recognizing that discussions around conservation, discussions around accessibility in the outdoors, discussions about social justice in outdoor spaces, and discussions around decarbonization and climate are all different discussions with different challenges and different components of making them less partisan, why they're partisan. And I find it personally to be really helpful to like get kind of specific. I'll kind of zoom out on that a little bit and share that when I first got into the space of social and political advocacy, I found a lot of solace in being focused. And I was like, cool. Climate is the thing I'm going to work on. It's the thing that I have the most tools around. It is the place where I have the most opportunities. It is the place where I have the most stories. And I was like, cool, I am going to be a climate guy. And it felt like that was a space where I could also like build expertise. And as I have continued into that work, I have found more and more that the best and most potent work that we can do is not in the siloed parts of these discussions, but in the intersectional parts of them. And so I know that those two points I just made are like, seem a little bit contradictory, but I think that kind of like looking at all of these bits of work as nodes that need to be kind of like brought forth in a nonpartisan way, if possible, I think that taking that kind of POV on this work and then looking at those intersections as the best places to actually get shit done is how I really kind of look at this sort of landscape.
Man, if there's one theme of every conversation we've had, it's that intersectionality. It's that, like, you know, like it's practical to have sort of this little bit of division of labor, but really,
or grounding.
If you're working on social justice and someone else is working on climate, or you're working on climate and someone else is working on labor issues, like whatever it is, we're working together towards a sort of bigger goal. Right?
Yeah,
it's the tightrope of, like, if everything is climate, then we can't start anywhere. But also to recognize where those points of intersection are. I mean, I work on climate governance. Like, one of the big tensions, right, is how do you do international policy that has context specific, like down to community level needs? How do you instantiate that there? And how do you have actual participation, right? So you're always dealing with this tension of, like, big scope, all consuming, you know, narrowing focus, it seems.
Totally. And I think that, like, something that I feel pretty strongly is that if we're looking at the climate movement specifically, there is so much emphasis on expertise. You are considered a better climate advocate the better you can speak on the specifics of policy or clean energy solutions or climate science. And like, those experts are crucial. Those experts are so important. Like, we need that depth. But what we need even more in the movement right now are more people who see themselves as part of the movement who are not experts. And more people who maybe, like, are representative of those intersections that we're talking about. We have the experts. We, like, have the technological solutions needed in order to take on climate. We have a lot of the, like, tools, like, in the academic space on, like, how we take on social justice. What we need is people who are curious, people who see themselves within that movement, people who represent those intersections, and also are doing a bunch of other shit, who are also, like, working in real jobs, people who are, like, general members of the public. And that's something that I'm personally, like, pretty dang focused on right now is that idea that, like, we just need more people in the tent, and we need those tents to be more connected. And that's what really movement building is all about. And it's hard because there's, like, so much kind of perceived need for expertise in a lot of these spaces, because it's really easy to shoot people down. It's really easy to be critical when people aren't, like, quite nailing it. And that's a hard thing to overcome. Now I do want to go back to part of the question you asked earlier around, like, how these things should be, like, made less partisan. Something I think about a lot, and I'm really curious for y'all's take on this. It's just the reason I want to go back to it. When I think about this work, when I think about, like, I consider my work to be movement building and bringing people in on the intersection of climate and social justice. That's, like, where I see the best work that I can do, and doing that through stories from the outdoor rec economy and community. And within that work, if I'm going to look at, like, America, we have the people on the left who are, like, generally on side and just need to be empowered, moved away from apathy, engaged. And then as we start trending across to the right, we have this group of people who are, like, right of center, who are, like, really are like this fabulous group of people with which we can engage, where we can have real conversations, where we can have conversations about, like, oh yeah, that, like, that stream flowing off of that glacier is something that I think about a lot because I walk along it to go up to the mountains, whereas you think about it a lot because you're fishing on it or you're hunting adjacent to it. And let's, like, utilize that shared landscape as a place where we can generate conversation. And let's, like, avoid all the wedge issues that get in the way and focus on the places where we have that, like, literal common ground, because
shared ground.
Yeah. Like, yeah, with those people, like, turns out, like, we actually agree on most things. And, like, core values tend to be pretty similar. But then there's this further to the right, a group of folks who, because of their core ideology or their theory of knowledge, like, I just do not have any alignment with. Like, we don't need to say names, but we know who we're talking about. And, like,
you know who you are.
Yeah. He who shall not be named.
They're not listening. probably not listening to this podcast. Dude,
yeah.
But, yeah.
But I actually, like, kind of am at this point where I'm like, cool, about 30% of America, I just don't really worry about. I'm just trying to work around them. I'm curious what you think of that.
So actually, on an early episode, we talked to an author who we both really admire her work, Emma Maris, and she sort of personally shared how she distinguishes between the folks arguing in good faith and arguing in bad faith, and suggested, look, if you recognize a bad faith argument, it's not really seeking any sort of legitimate dialogue and just ignore it. And I kind of agree with that to some extent, but I still think that there's sort of two things or maybe three things that we can do in the face of that. And so first, like, some of those folks you disagree with are going to argue in bad faith, where they're going to throw out the talking points just for the talking points, and that's not really what they mean. And then others are going to just simply disagree. They're not arguing in bad faith. They're strongly disagreeing from a real basic level. And I think you can kind of translate those into one group, and you can say, like, okay, if you're arguing in bad faith, let's find the good faith argument underneath that. Right. If these are all, if all the phrases you're using and points you're making are dog whistles for something else, let's try to lay that bare. So the first thing is, I think, like the old adage, the best disinfectant is sunlight. If someone says, like, oh, I don't believe in climate change because, like, it was pretty cold today, like, you can just, like, throw out that piece of their argument and say, like, no, like, let's talk about what's really behind this. Right. Like, it's not about the thermometer. We both know that. And for the most part, I think people find it disarming if you kind of try to make that explicit, because so often our response is to say, like, oh, well, no, let me talk about the difference between climate and weather. And we try to sort of correct them on the details. And I don't think it's about the details, right? So recognizing bad faith arguments and then trying to just, like, make it explicit and try to get to the deeper level of conversation is an important first step. And then we can say, like, okay, we disagree. Let's start there. I think then it's really important to figure out, Simone, you were talking to this, where do we disagree? Because if we disagree about facts, then there's a different conversation to be had than if we disagree about values. So I think it's super important to make really explicit what's my set of facts and what's my set of values. If you do that, at least in my experience, that 30% of America that you were saying, Graham, you disagree with, shrinks to 15%. Because I think a lot of people are uncomfortable when many of us who are either on the political left or care about climate change say, here's what's happening, so here's what we have to do about it. Because there's a really important jump I just made between a statement about how the world is to a statement about how the world ought to be. It may be the case that here's what's happening and there's a whole bunch of things we disagree about what we should do about it, right? Like, even if we agree on what's happening, doesn't mean we have to agree on what we should do about it. And I don't think that, I think, like, our community of people concerned about climate is really bad at recognizing when we make that jump. Like, I think we often say, like, cool, we're worried about what's happening, so, like, obviously we have to do X, Y, and Z. And if we stop between those two conversations, that community of folks that disagrees with us shrinks, because we can say, hey, here's what's happening. What do you think we should do about it? Right? Like, so that's one step. There's still some folks who say, like, no, like, yeah, I disagree about your facts. That can be really challenging, right? Like, then I think you need to get to a much more basic conversation about, like, what would it take to change your mind? And I think there's it's almost like when I get to that community, I'm not talking about climate change anymore, but I want to talk about, like, critical thinking. I want to talk about information gathering and like, not in a judgmental way. I genuinely want to find, like, okay, like, what's the common ground that we have, not on this issue, but on, like, generally thinking about the world and decision making? Now, there might be some.
But
folks
Alex, could that be like, it's you? Okay, fine. People are disagreeing now on, like, basic facts. We live in this post-truth world, and now, you know, misinformation is rampant. Blah blah blah. Isn't that then a way to maybe try to track towards values, though? Like, hey, you really care about your family and your well-being.
That's exactly what I was going to say with that last group. So that last group of folks, if you still don't agree on those facts, then you can flip it and you can say, look, I care about the world my daughter's going to grow up in. I care about what's happening in my backyard. I care about my fellow citizens. Maybe we don't agree on what's happening, but can you at least empathize with where I'm coming from because of what I care about that you might care about? Right. So there might be overlap on the fact side. There might be overlap on the value side. On top of all that, like the final thing I guess I'd say that I think is super important in these conversations, there's generally a narrative that I think is harming many of these conversations where when we get to the what we do about it, we don't present people with necessarily the most digestible path forward. And I think that shuts down conversations.
Okay, so I've got two things I want to bring up. These are not like disagreements.
Please.
This is more additive. And I think that the first one is a really interesting discussion. Are you all familiar with Molly Kawahata?
No.
She's a good pal who was on Obama's climate team. Really, really smart woman, thinking about like how we drive climate policy and climate solutions in a very like intersectional way. And she and I were on an expedition together, and we're just like, we're those like expedition conversations the last like days and days. And it just kind of came up like, why in the world would somebody vote for he who should not be named? And it was like, and she was like, dude, this is a group of people who feel like, they have not been addressed by American policy measures in a long time. They feel for like sure. they have been yep. Yep. ignored. And by simply yep. saying, I see you and I am with you, he was able to bring all those folks on side. And that has yep. continued. And I think that kind of bridging that into the other point I wanted to make is like we get stuck in this quagmire of like, what is the solution that we should do right now in this conversation around clean energy or climate or social justice or whatever? And that conversation is super important, but something that I have been finding more and more to be really useful to like both bring people together and drive the like climate positivity that I think is so badly needed. Like you were bringing up earlier, the like the doomsday narrative is just so pervasive yep. and it sucks. Yeah. It's like, I mean, yeah. Yeah. like breaking helpful. News right now is like awful. Like the news around climate is awful. Yeah. Like, the doomsday glacier is about to collapse and we're going to get 2 feet of sea level yeah. rise out of it. Like, yep. oh, great. And there's nothing we can do about it. Awesome. Okay. Whereas there's like this pathway where when we start talking about systemic climate solutions that bring everybody along on the journey, we can start talking about what that future looks like. And there's
yes, a yeah. shared it's like imagining like shared, of the good
like,
things.
What about this future where yes. like, Alex, I fly yes. up to Alaska yep. to go climbing with you, and I do so on a on decarbonized air travel, and sweet. We're able to like continue to do the stuff that we love, and we're able to do it in a decarbonized way. We're not faced with the yep. choice of like, do I get to go out to the outdoors that I love, or do I get to deal with climate? Like one or the other. Like,
yeah.
And that's like for the outdoor rec economy, and then mm-hmm. you start bridging that out to like, hey, like we want to move yeah. towards a future where like everybody has all the energy they need, everybody has all the tools they need to like live a good life, and we're able to do that in a decarbonized way. Like that future is like in front of us. That is a future that we yeah. can choose. And I find that to be something that if we can get super people to empowering. Lift their gaze a little bit, that that we can all head towards. And lifting your gaze gets really...
This is like the drum I beat with students, right? Like they're so... I've been teaching, over the past 15 years, and I've seen this pendulum switch. And, this comes to your question about like not atomizing responsibility and things like that, where students are now rightfully like saying there's these systemic structures, here's these big power players, but they've moved all the way towards a kind of nihilism to then say, well, there's nothing I can do about it, or the world's collapsing. And then my job as an educator is like, no, let's like think together about what just futures look like yeah. and constructing these sorts of things. And, to your point, those folks that are like elites that have the vested interest to keep the structures in place, not necessarily the people that are being disenfranchised from those things that might be goaded or convinced by those kinds of messaging. And, you know, I work with farming communities a lot, and that's like a very, that community is so spoken for in different ways and co-opted. So like out in Europe, right, they're casting farmers as climate deniers because they're resistant to a lot of these green initiatives. But if you ask and talk to folks, like farmers work the land. They're on the front lines. They are seeing the climate impacts. They're not climate deniers, but they are dealing with a kind of green austerity. And what they're worried about is inequality and their livelihoods. That's the value stuff. And that's a shared thing. So I really get frustrated when then people are like, oh, well, that's just a conservative community to ride off that's going to be against climate advancement. So just to put a, you know, a concrete example out there.
I super love that. And something that you brought up that I think is so important is decoupling the bad actors from the people who have been like brought along on that journey. We have like the cult leaders and then the poor folks who have been like brought along into the cult. And like the political actors, the bad actors who are like selling the snake oil, that is the problem. The problem is not the folks who have, due to whatever circumstance, ended up buying into it. And I think that like that's, and it's, and whether or not we can like in the short term, bring those folks on side through shared vision of like a future that we all want to live in, is a major question of like effort, but, and like where our energy is most, is like best applied. But I really think it's crucial to like, like point out where evil exists and where, and then just who's like operating underneath it.
Well, I think
and make it explicit.
So much of that,
to your sunshine point, Alex.
Yeah, exactly. Like sunshine's the best disinfectant. Like once you can tease that apart, right? We can engage. Like I think this is something we can all do a better job as folks who care about climate change, is engage in a kind of like radical empathy with people who disagree with us for good reasons. And like Simona, it's like similarly to what you're sharing about farming communities you work with, I see this in Alaska, where like Alaska is a pretty conservative state, but people here know, like, I don't know anybody who disagrees that climate change is happening. I know a lot of people that think we should be, you know, drilling as much oil as possible out of the North Slope, which I strongly disagree with. And so there's this like dissonance for me, but it's that they have very real concerns about what their job's going to be, where the education budget for the state is going to come from, how we're going to plow our roads. Like they have concerns that like, if I engage in this kind of like not just listening, but like radical empathy and try to understand that perspective, I think it's not that I think we need to like meet in the middle, but I think we need to recognize like, through those shared values, that we're not actually like coming at problems that differently, even if we're worried about.
And how to speak to the solutions.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll share another body of work that I've been digging into that's like very kind of climate adjacent, which I'm currently chair of the board of an organization called Dirt Road Organizing. And this is Chloe Maxman and Canyon Woodward and their work to bring progressive values into rural America. And it's super interesting. They were successful. So Chloe and Canyon met at Harvard, and they were a big part of the Harvard Divest movement, which was ultimately successful. The movement to get Harvard to divest their endowment from fossil fuels. And then after they graduated, Chloe went back to the rural town where she grew up in northern Maine and decided that she was going to test this hypothesis that she had around, what if I run as a Democrat in this district, which at that point was one of the most red districts in Maine, and ran for a state Congress seat. And instead of like just kind of taking on all of the normal talking points of the Democratic Party, instead like took all of those progressive values, but went to the folks and were like, what do you need? I'm here to get you what you need. and then I am going to work on bringing you that. And it was just, it was a pivot on the way that we generally communicate about progressive values in this country and how we like get at those things. And they were successful. So, Canyon came on as her campaign manager. They were successful. They won that seat. They subsequently ran, Chloe ran for a state Senate seat, won that seat. And then it's pretty cool. In these like very red areas, just like changing the language around progressive values, like and really focusing on that core tenet of meeting people there with where they're at with what they need. And now this organization that they are now running and that I help them with a lot is focused on providing that playbook to other folks who want to run on progressive values in ways that meet rural communities where they're at. And it's going really well. We've got a whole bunch of candidates that they're like coaching and working with it right now in the upcoming election. It's pretty exciting. And the success of that work is something that really demonstrates to me the importance of narrative and the importance of like holding strong on our values, but being okay with modulating our talking points in ways that meet people where they are. And that goes back to where we kind of started with like breaking down the people you're talking to into different audiences, like knowing like what is my personal mission statement or what is my personal value set that I'm going to bring to the world, and then understanding how to modulate that for the different audiences so that you can bring them in on that shared vision and then lead towards that like world that we all want to live in. And the two excellent. The two I mean, cruxes there are yeah. like audience research, which is a huge pain in the ass. You know, something you can spend. You want to talk about how much money like Coca-Cola spends on audience research, like millions and millions and millions of dollars. And me as one, like some hooligan hanging out in Bend, Oregon, it's like pretty under-resourced on that front. But but like you can, you know, something to constantly work on. And then also I think like really something I've done that has been super, super valuable. And this is sort of like getting us a little bit off track here, but doing like personal brand and values work to be like, here is like what the fuck I stand for. And all the work that I'm going to do is going to be in line with that. And like far end of that, like, don't be a bigot, but then like, what is the best work that I can do? And like,
yeah,
what
baselines.
And that's like, and, yeah. and that turns into like best way for me to focus my time, my energy. And then from that, you can build, you know, effectively communications plans. Yeah.
I think that's super interesting. Yeah. That's something that, like, obviously you have to do in a very explicit sense as a professional athlete, but that's something that we all do sort of in daily life implicitly with what we choose to take part of, with even like, you know, who our friends are, what activities we engage in.
What I do sometimes in my classes is an ethical autobiography for my students, which is I just offer them the opportunity to journal, like, what are some of my committed principles and values and views, and like, where did they come from? So it's just a way for them to get to reflect, like, oh, that they might have committed views and principles, and that they might have come from somewhere. And it's just, I do this at the beginning of the class, knowing that part of what you do when you engage in you know, an ethics or political philosophy class is you're going to interrogate some underlying assumptions or commitments that maybe you weren't really knew that you had explicitly or that you have deeply rooted commitments to. So it's a way to just kind of prime open-mindedness, or I don't know, using the word empathy, Alex. Like a lot of students, I did this once in a 350-person class, and they were so keen to read their stuff out loud the second day of class to each other, which I found really interesting, which was just like they were willing to share because they themselves found it really interesting because they had never sat back and had that kind of meta thought about like, oh yeah, why do I think this? So, you know, kids were going into these family narratives and things like that. So it's not necessarily personal branding, because branding makes you feel like then you have to be committed maybe to a particular thing and not allow for change or flexibility, but rather to have a kind of iterative process of self-transparency. And if you do want to have, I guess, consistent commitments to your ethical beliefs or your principles, what are the things that you're going to have to junk? What are the things you're going to have to reintroduce? And you do that kind of reflective equilibrium in your own thinking. So maybe that, you know, that's the like philosophy version of maybe where we agree on this.
I'll just chime in that I've spent a lot of time over the last like 2 years. And this is partially, you mentioned that I wrote a book earlier, Alex, and I wrote this book called The Fine Line. And it's all about like defining balance or harmony kind of between the climbing that I love to do and things like my marriage and my career in climate advocacy. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the process of writing that book was meditating on the like the purpose, the value, the meaning of all this climbing that I've been doing. I mean, somebody asked me recently, like, if I do a lot of camping, and it was like, I've spent thousands and thousands and thousands of nights in a tent over the last 15 years. And over the last 25 years or whatever. And it's like,
I might voiceover introduce you as Graham Zimmerman, professional camper.
Yeah. Aggressive hill walker. And the thing that I keep landing on, the two things that like are the defining components, are the lessons that I have learned in the mountains and the partnerships that I have made. And those are the two things, like the landscapes, the views, the sense of, you know, cool, I got to the top of that badass hill. Like that stuff is all great. But the things that matter the most are like those lessons about how to do really big, challenging things without guaranteed outcomes, and how to strategize into them, and then how to build these teams in order to take that on, and like the relationships that have come from those teams. And that is like it. I think that like when we're talking about our reasons for going outside, when we're talking about this modern philosophy, when we're talking about our love of landscapes, like we as us who are talking on this call are like finding a ton of common ground, shared value. And I think that's something that I really, if we're going to talk about like shared value of like keeping that stream from overheating so there are fish in it, or if we're going to talk about maintaining air quality in urban areas, or we're going to talk about like why we are curious about the teachings of Nietzsche or of Stoicism and Marcus Aurelius, it's like we're talking about things around which we have so much more common ground than we have divided ground. And I think that's just something that I see across such a spectrum of the communities that we're working with, and that we can oftentimes be perceived to be working against. Like we have just so much more shared space. And I just, something that is highly aspirational, but I do think about a lot, and something that I really do gain a lot of like positive affirmation from is that like anybody I look at on the street, I probably have way more in common with them than I don't. And that's something that is like, there is a lot of optimism that you have to build into that. It's very easy not to be optimistic in a political climate like we have right now, but it's like, I think it does remain true.
What has it been like bringing other athletes into this work?
Oh, that's a really cool question. I think that when we look broadly at athletes, like across all sports, NBA, NFL, tennis, you know, like soccer, football, sports at large has this incredible tradition of driving change in the world around it. And that's something that I think that the outdoor industry and the outdoor kind of like sports world is a muscle that it is just learning how to use. And I really consider a big part of my work to be teaching these folks who have these baseline skills and ability to like do really hard things, to train and be strategic and build teams to take on these audacious tasks like climbing huge mountains or winning 100-mile races, and giving them the tools and the encouragement and the resourcing in order to apply some of that effort and know-how to deal with these massive problems that we are facing. And to be able to go to them and say like, hey, I bet you think that Serena Williams kicks ass. What if I told you that I think you can have a similar impact on the world around you? And it's not something I need to like teach you a new skill set. I just need to teach you how to like use what you already have in a slightly different way. And if we want to talk about things that give me a lot of optimism, it is that like unleveraged, unutilized source of potential change. And that's something that I'm super deeply invested in. And so I really deeply believe in athletes as folks who can change the world around them, and that they are folks who can do it by bringing people together towards these sports that we all love. And the thing that the one other thing I'll add to that is with the outdoor rec economy community, like there is the pillar of shared activity, but then there's this additional pillar of shared landscape. And within the outdoor sports space, we're able to combine those two. And that gets me so fucking stoked. And if you want to hear why I'm optimistic that I think we can like make this, make the outcome of this election what we need it to be, well, how we can like make sure that we are steering our country and our society and our globe towards like what we need. Like it is those pockets of unleveraged potential. And I feel really, really fortunate to be just like eyeballs deep in one of them, just working hard to make it real.
Well,
so that was an awesome conversation with Graham.
It was a lot.
Way more than for the listeners. There was 2 hours of a conversation.
We chatted for 2 hours. That, I mean, when you invite such an experienced camper on, there's going to be a lot to talk about.
Professional walker up hills and tent guy.
Big tent guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe we should change the intro to Graham Zimmerman. Big tent guy.
Big tent guy. Professional Sisyphus, I suppose, or something like that.
But no, yeah. That was great. I really appreciated Graham's perspective and that whole conversation. You know, Graham really like approached the question of responsibility. It seemed to me like from two perspectives. One, as an outdoor athlete, it obviously motivates a sense of responsibility. Like he sees changes as an outdoor athlete and has this connection and love for outdoor landscapes that has motivated a desire to protect them. But also, I think he sees that as an athlete, this platform gives him a responsibility to share that perspective and to share those stories.
Yeah, something that,
I mean, obviously
really,
responsibility is a huge topic.
Yeah,
but that's a good that was a great place to start.
Yeah, I really think so. And you know, we could and should go on a lot about responsibility, questions of
future episodes.
Stay tuned, right? Especially about what happens when people don't fulfill and who those people are, their responsibilities as their other responsibilities to take that up, you know, questions about role-based responsibilities. But something that really struck me, I think, in our conversation with Graham is a particular kind, well, two main kind of key points, a particular kind of pragmatism when it comes to the responsibility of communication. So, and, you know, this seems to be a theme kind of cropping up across our episodes where, what is it? Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, where you try to find the kinds of shared or common language, not necessarily have to be a purist in the way that you are messaging. He spoke a lot about
I think there's an important point there, which is that like we should all be true to our values,
yes,
but we should let our language not just evolve, but it's okay if our language adapts to different contexts,
exactly,
and different communities.
Yes.
Right. Like,
yes.
Like our values are that's the key thing that we need to be true to. But if we're talking to different people, we might have to use different words, and we just have to recognize that as a practical constraint.
Yeah. It's not a compromising, right, of your value commitments to actually be striving to find commonality across values and know that those kinds of expressions might look different depending on that. And that actually connects then with, you know, the second thing that I found really interesting, and maybe this is still a theme around responsibility of communication, but it really is then the power of narrative. So, you know, it's one thing if you come in and, you know, you proclaim a lot of ought statements, right, about what we ought to be doing. And that might have a certain kind of purchase. But really, by just demonstrating, by showing, by starting with narratives about experiences, that allows an entry point in to a kind of engagement where you're then able to reveal sets of shared values, perhaps, even if they do take on different kinds of forms of expressing them, that at least creates some sort of... I guess, starting point in order to bring more folks into the climate movement. So that seems to be at least what was coming through with what Graham was saying a lot was just how do you create a movement? How do you mobilize folks? And that to me seemed like a really important takeaway and a lesson we could all be learning.
Thanks for listening to this episode of A Hostile Climate. The show is hosted by Alex Lee and Simona Capisani. And it's produced by me, Cody Nelson. Our theme music is by Mark Shapiro, and our show art is by Jean Julien. Just a reminder that A Hostile Climate is an independently produced podcast, and we count on listeners like you to help us keep making more episodes. If you'd like to donate to support the show, you can find information on our website, ahostileclimate.org. And please make sure you're following us wherever you're listening to this, and if you like what you hear, leave us a 5-star rating and tell a friend. Thanks again. See you next time.